In the exploration of the practice on this retreat, one of the maybe themes that has been resonating for me in my practice and in conversations with people before the retreat and coming into the retreat is this connection between the development of wisdom, the cultivation of wisdom, and the nurturing, the development of love. That first sutta that we explored, the simile of the cloth, lays it out pretty explicitly. That we explore understanding our hearts and minds, understanding those reactive habits and patterns, which supports the mind abandoning them. And out of that is the growth of some, it's described in the suttas at least, it's not described as taking a lot of work, but more of a natural, lawful unfolding. That with the understanding and abandoning follows some beautiful qualities that support our practice, confidence, delight, joy, tranquility, happiness, concentration. And then the sutta describes from there, one abides in metta, one abides in compassion. Again, a very natural result as it's described. And we've been talking about how that might work, how that might happen. That the very way that we're encouraged to be aware, that the interest in just what's here, not judging, allowing, being with the entirety of our experience, that allowing wise attention brings together wisdom with metta, with love, with care. I think I offered the kind of analogy that if you had a friend with you when you were going through something really awful, or a complete mess, and your friend was just, you know, sitting with you and saying, it's okay, however you are, I'm here with you. I still love you. I'm still here with you. Just that willingness to be with, the willingness to just sit with you in the midst of your mess, that would be felt as so much care and connection and love. And that really is, I think, the capacity of this kind of attention as being that kind of relationship. And so with this already, I mean, with this as our way to approach practice, love and wisdom kind of grow together. the activity of remembering awareness and cultivating an allowing attitude, noticing when the attitude isn't allowing, and allowing that, all of that is developing the wholesome qualities of mindfulness, of non-reactivity, of equanimity, of patience, of metta. And the cultivation of wisdom naturally cultivates these wholesome qualities of heart. And I think the wholesome qualities of heart support and nourish wisdom, help us to hold the wisdom, really, in some ways, too. You know, the wisdom, the truth of the world, the truth of the way things are. Impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable. Living with that really helps to have some compassion and care for ourselves and others. And so the qualities of the Brahmaviharas, the divine abidings, love, compassion, joy, and equanimity, support the mind to be able to hold the truth, to be able to meet the truth. There's also another way I understand that love and wisdom connect. In a different way, kind of how a confused relationship with love and wisdom with a confused relationship with between love and wisdom, we get so tangled up. And stress and suffering, dukkha. So dukkha, the Pali term for suffering or stress, unsatisfactoriness, the Buddha talked about it as based in greed, aversion, and delusion. And so the struggle that we experience isn't inherent in anything that's happening. It lies in our relationship to it. It lies in our relationship when that relationship has greed, aversion, or delusion in it, we will suffer. And it's our minds that are doing that. It's possible to change our minds. To recognize that relationship as being not necessary, and that relationship being the suffering. That's not to say that there are not situations in the world that are unjust, that there are unethical things happening around us. There are definitely things like this going on, and yet the understanding in terms of the practice and where we suffer and how we suffer is that when we resist or fight, hold on to, are not kind of in alignment with this is the way it is. So that this is the way it is, you know, the unethical things are happening. And the relationship to that could be anger, hatred, fear. Often is. And yet what the understanding is that anger, that hate, that fear is creating suffering internally, contributes to the suffering externally, and is not actually creating conditions for a skillful shift of the conditions. So the, you know, an exploration around meeting unethical experience, unethical situations, things that are unjust, the encouragement, the understanding is that if the heart is not constricted around that, the heart is not in a space of greed or aversion or delusion around what has come to be, about around the injustice that has come to be. The heart is not in hatred and anger and fear around that injustice that has come to be. There is much more capacity to respond to that injustice skillfully, with compassion. When the heart is open and it meets suffering, it meets injustice, that open heart, that unconstricted heart, wants to act to alleviate suffering. Compassion wants to act to alleviate suffering. And so there's a little, I think the anger, you know, the anger feels like, well, if I wasn't angry, then why would I do anything to alleviate this injustice? That's the belief of anger. But anger doesn't understand how compassion works. Anger believes it's the motivator. It doesn't understand that compassion also motivates. So this idea that, you know, if the heart did not have a, you know, angry response to injustice, then the injustice would just continue. That's a misunderstanding of how our hearts actually work. So given this understanding that the suffering, the dukkha that we experience is the construction of our minds, the minds are in relationship to experience with greed, with aversion, with delusion, and that this is so deeply conditioned, it's like, you know, this is how we all are. Pretty much everyone on the planet is engaged in habitual responses of greed, aversion, and delusion to the situations they find themselves in. And, you know, since this is something going on in our minds, and it creates suffering, we might ask, and actually it's come up in the groups, one of the groups, you know, why does the mind do this? Why does it do this? I've explored this a little bit in my own practice. You know, why? Why does the mind like think anger is helpful? What's going on there? Why does it think fear is going to do something for me? I think I not long ago said something about the way our system works, the way our organism works. It seems to have a movement or a direction, a natural kind of inclination to move in the direction of well-being. At least this is some of what I've read in neurobiology, kind of this movement towards having some kind of settledness or homeostasis, the word was. And yet when we look at how our minds try to move towards well-being, how what, you know, our system tries to move towards well-being, it seems like we try to take the quickest route possible. Get what I want. Get rid of what I don't want. And we get some well-being there. When we get something that we want, we do have a little bit of a hit of, phew, that feels better. Got what I wanted. And so that process then just reinforces that the way to feel better is to get what I want or get rid of what I don't want. And it takes, you know, someone like the Buddha to actually go in and look and say, wow, this getting what I want, is that actually creating happiness? Seems to be just reinforcing that getting what I want will make me happy. And I'm caught on an endless cycle of that. There's not a stability of happiness there. As soon as I get what I want, it's already falling apart and the mind is already thinking about the next way it's going to get what it wants. It's not very stable. And so this movement, you know, this movement towards well-being, it's a natural movement of pretty much any living system, any living organism. Even like single-celled amoebas will move towards food and away from noxious chemicals. So there's a, you know, kind of like natural movement towards what will create a sense of okayness in the organism. And I think this, you know, this is my own theory, but I think this movement towards well-being is very connected to the wish, the inner kind of wish for ease and happiness, the wish of metta. When we connect to metta, we express that, may I be happy, may I be healthy. And this movement towards well-being is kind of a manifestation or somehow expression of that deep inner wish. And so the movement towards well-being is not misguided. It's just confused. And that confusion seems to be related to or connected to this I guess I'll say that much of the struggle, much of the way that we suffer feels like it's related to this like collision or recognition that I want to be happy, I want to be healthy, I want to be safe. And that runs up against the nature of reality, impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable. We have these two. It's wish to be happy, wish to be safe. Oh, and by the way, nothing can be controlled. Nothing's reliable. Things are impermanent. They're not going to last. And the experience of suffering seems to have both of these components in it. So I think when I've really explored and looked at pretty much any time I'm caught in something, doesn't matter what I'm caught in something, there's some like piece of that being caught that's related to wanting to be happy, healthy, safe, and at ease. And the caughtness is kind of around how that wish to be happy, healthy, safe, and at ease is running up against, oh, but things are impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable. And the mind, the habitual response of the mind is that these two do not coexist. There's a problem here. And the feeling is, I mean, that this what feels to me is like that these threads basically get knotted up, they get tangled up. The human wish for ease, happiness, and impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable, we get a tangle. The mind basically, you know, want to be safe. Uncontrollable. No! Fear results, confusion results, anger results. But I've been thinking about this as, you know, just in terms of an image or an analogy, what feels really helpful to me to think about is to think about the suffering as the tangle. The tangle, that there's nothing in the in all of those threads that's problematic. It's the configuration of those threads that's problematic. It's the knotting that's problematic. Maybe we can think of the tangle is, you know, kind of like familiar strategies to deal with seemingly irreconcilable wishes and truths. That deep wish for safety and recognizing uncertainty, vulnerability, and anxiety arises. How can I navigate this? How can I get out of this? How can I fix this? How can I change this? There's an interesting thing, an interesting kind of dynamic that seems to happen between these two that's really useful to recognize and practice. And one is that sometimes we see and we hear, in particular around the truths of impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable. And I've talked to people in practice meetings who are saying, you know, I'm feeling all this fear, but you know, it's uncontrollable, and you know, I can see I really want to be happy, but things are uncontrollable, so you know, that's just the way it is, right? That vulnerability, that's just the way it is. And in the undercurrent of that is a little bit of denial of the validity of the wish to be safe. If things are unreliable, then I shouldn't want to be safe. little bit of that, you know, that, a little misunderstanding of the wisdom that's expressed. Kind of almost bludgeoning ourselves with this truth. Well, it's unreliable, so yeah, safety is not, you know, not in the cards, so don't want it. But that wish for safety is a deeply human wish, and it's a wholesome wish. Now, we also get confused around those wishes, thinking or feeling like, okay, I want to be safe. If I can't be safe on my terms, then there's a problem. That there's the other side of this, you know, these two getting tangled up, you know, it's like wishing to be safe and the world is wrong. Either there's something wrong with the world, it's the world's fault that it's impermanent, and there's something to blame there, or I've done something wrong, or somebody else has done something wrong, rather than just recognizing, no, this is just kind of the way it is. It's unreliable. So this, for me, this understanding of the tangle is the suffering, helps to kind of give a different feeling about the suffering. The suffering, you know, when there's that, when suffering is happening, when some kind of reactivity is happening, it's like there's the opportunity, it's got the threads in there of the wish for well-being and some pointing to the truth. Wisdom. Our minds can't hold in some ways that these two things, seemingly disparate kind of things in our experience, love and wisdom, love and truth, don't seem to line up or work together. But wisdom kind of asks us to simultaneously open to love and truth, and that the heart can actually hold both. That's possible. The tangle itself is asking for attention, is asking for honoring, partly because it is composed of these threads of love and wisdom. When I first started practicing and really deeply saw how much anger there was and how painful it was. I mean, I knew I had anger, but I didn't really feel it until I started practicing. And it just felt wholly bad. You know, it felt like it was a tumor of some kind that just needed to be excised, gotten rid of, you know. And, you know, I just imagined finding the edges of that, taking the scalpel and, like, throwing it out. That's what I thought would have to happen. I think that that creates a kind of an attitude of repression, of aversion to those patterns and habits. Certainly I had. But if we think about the way, you know, anger works, in this case there was a, you know, a wish to be happy, to have connection and love, to be in relationship, to have that kind of connection, and the, you know, the deeply uncontrollable, unreliable way I couldn't control another person. And there was so much anger there around how that person had treated me. So, you know, so the uncontrollability and the wish for connection getting all tangled up. But I didn't understand it that way. And so I was thinking, it's just, you know, this is bad. This anger is bad. But as I did begin to practice and explore, you know, all flavors, whole different flavors of reactivity, there was one particular experience I had around fear. It was right around a little after, maybe 10 days or so after the September 11th attacks, and I was flying back from my parents where I had been when that happened. And so I was on one of the, I think it was the second day after the flight started up again. So I was, you know, there were some conditions there around fear, around, you know, being in an airplane and, you know, all of that. And my flight was delayed from where my parents were. I had the layover in Houston, and I was supposed to get the next flight out, but I had missed the last flight of the day, and so I had to get a hotel and stay overnight in Houston. And in the middle of the night, there was a blackout. And I, you know, I thought, oh, maybe it's just a hotel. And I looked out my window, and the entire city, everywhere I could see, it was black. And, you know, the context here had been September 11th. George Bush was president of the United States, and I was at George Bush International Airport. What a perfect place for a terrorist attack. My mind kind of did this explosion and went into fear. Now, all of this, of course, in my mind, and it was not a terrorist attack, but, you know, there was a lot of fear there. And, you know, lots of images in my mind of what I would do if it was a terrorist attack. It was like this massive thing. And I began just trying to be with it, just practice. Wow, this is really strong. And I found kind of spontaneously at certain points, the mind went into metaphrases. May I be happy. May all beings be happy. May all beings be safe. Boy, did that one resonate. That one was so aligned with where my mind was with the fear. May all beings be safe. It's like, whew. When the mind was in that space, it was like there was not the suffering. The fear wasn't there. It's like it was really landing in that, yes, may all beings be safe. That's what the heart really wants. And then it would kind of, you know, get all agitated again and proliferate into, you know, hiding in the hallways and how are we going to, like, prevent ourselves from getting damaged. And, you know, it's like, and then, oh, may all beings be safe. And in that exploration back and forth, this is really where I got this sense of the fear and the metta. And it felt like they were kind of coming from the same place, only it's like the fear was all twisted and confused and tangled and knotted up. The wish for safety, that felt very clean. And so this is like the, yeah, this is interesting. They're connected. It's like follow the thread of fear back to the wish for safety. My heart really landed with that. And now I see and understand that really what the fear was the, you know, the kind of the getting tangled up with the uncontrollability, the unreliability of the world, the nature of the world. You know, it wasn't a terrorist attack. It might have been, it could have been. And so the tangle there was between those two. So in looking at these reactive habits and patterns, if we have patience, if we open to, in the way we've been talking about, all the way we've been talking about, being with, allowing, curious, holding our reactive patterns and habits, it's like that mindfulness and wisdom is a lubricant that lets the tangle untangle. If we were to follow that model of, you know, my idea of like, oh, gotta get the, you know, scalpel out and cut that habit or pattern out entirely. If we do that with the tangle, get the scissors out and cut the tangle out, you end up with a hole in the cloth. And my feeling of the way these wholesome qualities work and the way the mind is understanding wisdom, you know, this, I think this is some of why it's so difficult, some of these reactive habits and patterns have such a hold on us, because there is the tangle of love and wisdom. Only our mind doesn't understand how love and wisdom can coexist. So it thinks, you know, in order to be happy, I've got to do this thing or fix this thing. It doesn't understand that there can be this like weaving of these threads rather than the tangle of the threads. So the coming around to the cultivation or the natural development of love and wisdom that the sutta describes. The simile of the cloth describes. Another way, I think, that from the cultivation of wisdom, from the seeing, from the allowing those tangles to sit in the bath and become disentangled, it's like the love and the wisdom are freed up from the tangle. The love and the wisdom are freed up from the tangle. And they're available. They're available in our experience. Kind of like that experience I talked about, kind of seeing really want all beings to be safe with such a deep, deep connection. So as we explore and open to our difficulties, as the mindfulness can see through the clinging, the craving, the tangle, as it sees through the tangle, what's left is the love and the truth. So every suffering, every kind of difficult pattern that arises in our system, to me it's like it deserves honoring and respect because it's the opportunity to see these threads, to open to them, to free them up from the tangle so they can come back and support us in other ways. So this is another way I see the natural growth of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity through the practice, not just through the cultivation of those qualities in the practice, but by through what is seen, releasing the potential. You know, it's like the potential of love and wisdom is knotted up in those patterns and habits, and the seeing through it releases that potential. Craving takes up so much energy, tangles us up in so much. And it's like with that freedom from that reactive pattern, there's not only a kind of an energy release, but also the love and the wisdom that were there. I've seen this so many times in my practice. Surprising, like things I never would have expected. One time, I'll give this example. This was really startling for me, looking at depression over the course of several weeks at Shui Yu Min, practicing with Sayadaw. Seeing it from a number of angles and had a lot of theories about what it was about, a lot of ideas, but just was curious about it, watching it kind of come and go, noticing it wasn't always there, seeing when it arose, got kind of interested in the patterns and habits around when it arose. And one of the times I saw it arise was when I saw people walking and talking together. I felt the depression come in. And at Shui Yu Min, we were encouraged to practice mindful speaking. So this was not like doing something wrong. It was just a part of the practice at Shui Yu Min. And I would, you know, be just doing my walking and I'd see people together and I'd feel this like, oh. And so I had this theory, you know, that this somehow was connected to some like deep conditioning from childhood and like not having friends on the playground, you know, that kind of thing. I had this theory. But I was wise enough to kind of set it aside. At some point, really watching the fluctuation between the feeling of depression, and then it would vanish, and then it would come back, and I'd be caught by it, and then the caught would go away, but the depression would... So just watching this, like, almost mind-blowing fluctuation of the states of the mind around depression. At one point, I just sat with it, seeing things change rapidly, and at a certain point, I just felt like, wow, this feeling of depression, it's big, it's really big. And I let it, like, just get as big as it wanted to. Like, wow, it's big. How big is it? And at some point, as it just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, it felt like it flipped inside out. And the experience was vast. Love. That was not what I expected to find in the middle of depression. The next thought was, so there's this vast feeling of love, and the very next thought was something like, this is stupid, this is sappy, this is corny. And that was a little bit of like, okay, that feels like that's probably where the depression's coming from. Repression around the love. Like thinking it's stupid somehow. throwing a wet blanket on it. Not supposed to feel that way. That's like Hallmark greeting card, you know. So I was like, okay, there's work to do here. But there was something so interesting about seeing the relationship between the believing, you know, some idea, and just that feeling of love, and just how connected that pattern was. I would not have thought that there was something like that inside the depression. So this is another reason why I often encourage people to just, you know, just sit with things. Don't like look for things. If you go looking for something, I'm sure if I'd gone looking, I probably could have found some connection to that time on the playground. You know, the way I felt, you know, shunted aside and not included. And I'm sure I could have found it. Whatever we look for, we can kind of find. So really just curious about what's there and allowing the mindfulness and wisdom to reveal these threads and how those threads get tangled up. The untangling of the tangle is wisdom's job. And it's good at it if we let it do its job. It will release and allow that cultivation, the release of the wisdom, the love, the understanding of the wisdom, those will happen simultaneously. And so this connection between love and wisdom, connection between the heart opening and connecting and caring and the development of understanding, these two go right together. The suttas have use this analogy of the tangle. I'll end with the poem there from the suttas. Tangled inside and tangled outside. This generation is tangled in a tangle. I think all generations are tangled in a tangle. Tangled inside, tangled outside. This generation is tangled in a tangle. I ask you this. He's asking the Buddha this question. I ask you this. Who can untangle this tangle? The Buddha responds, a wise person, grounded in ethics, developing the mind and wisdom. One keen and alert, that person can untangle the tangle. Those in whom greed, hate, and ignorance have faded away, they have untangled the tangle. So maybe knowing or understanding that our suffering has this opportunity of expressing or opening to love and wisdom. Maybe there can be a sense of real honoring, not giving into But the willingness to understand what is happening in our struggles and our stress, our suffering, to honor those tangles. Honor them with awareness and wisdom. And let the tangle untangle. May your practice support untangling the tangle.